thanks for coming along with us for Closer Look. I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Rose Scott. Fracking in Georgia, well, that's a topic bound to draw heated debate. Opponents argue injecting liquid into the earth to hopefully extract oil or gas is not environmentally friendly. Supporters say it could mean jobs for Georgia. So we're going to explore the issue and how it works. We're joined by Kurt Ebersbach. He's a senior energy attorney with Southern Environmental Law Center, and Dr. Chloe Arson with the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Georgia Tech. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin with the beginning for some that may be listening saying, what in the world is fracking? Well, Dr. Arson, we'll start with you. Sort of go in a little bit deeper about what the process of fracking.
Yeah, sure. So hydraulic fracturing means injecting fluids under pressure. That's the exact definition. Now, what we understand by hydraulic fracturing in shale is a process of drilling overall that includes doing a vertical wellbore that goes up to the shale formation, typically 6,000 feet deep. So that means that at a certain point, you'll go through the aquifer. You will put a casing in to make it impermeable, go through, and then at a certain starting point, you'll start inclining your bore to make it horizontal so that when it reaches the shale formation, your borehole is actually horizontal. Once it's formed, then the process of hydraulic fracturing, meaning really injecting fluids under pressure, gets started.
And so by doing all that, it's easier to detect natural gas or oil that way?
The fact is, reserves of natural gas have been detected in shale. Shale is a sedimentary rock that contains pores of very different sizes. And the gas is actually contained in nanopores. That means pores that have a size of 1 millionth of millimeter in size. So it's a few molecules. To extract that natural gas, you need to trigger diffusion processes. And that is done by producing fractures that will create chemical imbalances to make the gases naturally diffuse through the rock into the fractures. And from the fractures, a flow can be created to extract it. So is it easier? Maybe not, but that's the only way in shale.
Now, Georgia is not one of the centers for fracking right now. Other states have had intense debates about this. Kurt Ebersbach, let's bring you into this. Do we even know at this point what the potential haul is, if you will, from Georgia, or is there even agreement on what our potential is?
There's agreement that the northwest portion of the state has some proven gas reserves. It's my understanding some of those areas have been explored, but are not yet producing gas, and I think that's largely a function of low natural gas prices. It's simply not worth it for some of those companies to come in and try to extract the natural gas. But we should remember that natural gas prices historically are volatile. They will go back up at some point in the future. And I think when that happens, Georgia will be back on the map, so to speak, for fracking activity. And I think it's very important before that happens for there to be an appropriate regulatory structure in place that's protective of local communities and the environment. That's something that North Carolina is going through right now, evaluating the risks of fracking, putting the appropriate protections in place before fracking proceeds.
Well, let's take a couple of the questions that come up. And Dr. Arson, we'll start with you, but Kurt Ebersbach, jump in on this if you want. Starting off with, you mentioned this is a hydraulic process. It requires huge amounts of water. Northwest Georgia, if it's one of the places we could go, has also experienced in recent years tremendous drought. We don't have that right now, certainly not today, but we could see it again. Won't that be a problem if we're using so much water in that area for fracking?
There could be problems with water consumption. That's one of the main issues when we talk about environmental risks associated to hydraulic fracturing. Let's note, though, that 40% of the water consumption in the U.S. is for the cooling of thermoelectric plants. And only 1% of these 40% represents what we use for hydraulic fracturing in the U.S. today. So that gives numbers. This being said, over the lifespan of one well, each well consumes about 3 to 38 swimming pools of fresh water. So what could be the alternatives? Maybe recycling the fluids injected. Today, about 15 to 50% of the fluids injected are recuperated for recycling.
Now, how safe is that, though? Because you have chemicals that are generated by the process, and if you recycle them in the wrong places, wouldn't that pose a risk?
Yeah, so that is a different issue indeed. So water consumption is one. The second one is indeed the risks of water pollution. There are different things that can cause pollution according to the latest studies. One is the fluid injected, but that could be also the product of the reaction between the fluid and the rock. So that are not only due to the fluid injected, but also due to the presence of minerals or radionuclides already present in the rock. So that requires a lot of investigation. Let us note last figure, 99.5% of the fluid injected is water and sand. The rest is a mixture of products that you usually find in household products, but that includes acids and other products. And what is not always known is the composition of the waste flow liquid that comes out after the reaction of the rock, and disposition and leakage and spills could be indeed an issue if there is no proper monitoring or understanding of the processes.
Well, let's talk about another risk or issue here, because the U.S. Geological Survey had released what they called a landmark study about the frequency of earthquakes that they thought might be caused by what they call human activities, such as drilling or hydraulic, fracturing. Do we know? This is their survey, but Kurt, I'll start with you. Is there any concrete evidence that sort of suggests a link there between fracking and earthquakes? Do we know for sure?
I believe there is. What I've read from the state of Oklahoma, for example, was that the industry continually maintained that they weren't causing earthquakes until they were basically forced to admit that they were. When you go from having a couple dozen earthquakes per year to having many thousands of earth tremors and earthquakes, then you know there's something happening. And here, I believe the it was not just correlation, but also causation, that all of this drilling occurring in a state like Oklahoma that has many wells is in fact causing some of those problems.
Well, Dr. Arson, can you explain that too for our listening audience that says, wow, how can that cause earthquakes?
Well, anytime you inject or withdraw fluids in the rock, you'll produce vibrations. So that's called induced microseismicity, so that exists, that is proven. You produce waves when you do so. Now, the real question is there any risk of triggering earthquakes by reactivating faults, for example? So I read the latest report of the National Research Council that was published 2 years ago, and the conclusion is there is no real evidence that hydraulic fracturing per se causes earthquakes that would have a magnitude over 2, which is the magnitude that you need to feel some tremors. This being said, they also emphasize the fact that we need proper monitoring before injecting and during injection to really make proper correlations.
And who wants to monitor that?
Right. So a really sound and reliable data set is really hard to find, because usually monitoring over years was not necessarily made where people made wells afterwards. So,
if you've just joined us, we're talking about fracking and the questions surrounding it with Kurt Ebersbach, Senior Energy Attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, and Dr. Chloe Arson with the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Georgia Tech. Dr. Arson talked about this a little bit, Kurt, and I want to toss this to you, because opponents of fracking bring up many of the environmental hazards that they think might be associated with it. But she also mentioned some of the environmental benefits. And isn't one of them a pretty good reduction in carbon dioxide pollution? Because as big coal users, like power plants, continue to shift from coal to natural gas, which is available in large amounts through fracking, aren't we going to see perhaps even greater benefits than liabilities for the use of fracking, because carbon dioxide pollution is a major problem right now?
Carbon emissions, yes. Methane emissions, perhaps not. So it's true that natural gas does have about half of the carbon emissions as the combustion of coal. But natural gas, which is essentially methane and some other compounds, is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So there's been some discussion in the industry of the problem of methane leaks from wells. There's some debate about how extensive that is. But if it is a problem, and we think it is a problem, you're potentially canceling out any climate benefit that you get from greater reliance on natural gas. So that's something that really has to be looked at too, and has to be part of any regulatory regime that governs fracking.
Dr. Arson, do you agree with him that methane leaks are a realistic hazard, or is that something that is just potentially out there that we could control somehow?
It was proven that on certain wells there were some leaks of methane. However, the question I would like to raise, and I do not have the answer, is it specific to hydraulic fracturing? Is it specific to unconventional oil and gas exploitation? It seems that even in water wells, you have such leaks. So maybe the question is bigger than just the question of hydraulic fracturing. It's the energy demand and production overall that would probably need to be looked at. And yeah, also I agree with the fact that because we tend to replace coal-based electricity production by natural gas-based electricity production, we emit less CO2 thanks to this. But the methane issue is still an issue that requires research.
Let's talk about the economics of this. And Kurt, I'll throw this to you, because a private landowner may say, you know what, it's my land. I'm going to allow for someone to come in. I don't mind fracking. It's going to be, you know, probably potentially money for me. But then the state may say, well, you know what, we're going to ban this whole fracking industry. So where do you draw the line here? Because a private property, obviously, versus public property, someone, if they want to allow someone to come on their land and drill, they should be allowed to do it.
Well, I believe that local communities should have the right to make up their minds about whether fracking is right for their community. And so this is an issue that's come up in other states. Mm-hmm. Do local governments have the ability to prohibit or just to limit fracking, to put in place restrictions like setbacks from wells, from nearby streams or rivers? Those are very important issues to consider. So property owners have rights, obviously. Local communities also have rights to say what can and can't occur there. So I do think that is an important component as well of any regulatory structure, is whether local communities retain that right. I would point out one other issue, though, and this kind of turns your question on its head. There's a phenomenon in the industry known as forced pooling, and that's where property owners who don't want to be fracked can sometimes be swept in because enough property owners around them have sold their rights to the minerals underneath their land. And so even if you don't want to allow fracking under your property, in some states, in fact, in a majority of states, a gas company can come in and still drill beneath your property without your permission. So that's something that I think that private property owners would want to recognize as well, because I think many would consider that an interference with their property rights.
And how closely is your organization looking at what's happening in other states? I know California and New York both have some very specific laws and even some legislation that's going to come up this year. How close are you all watching what happens in those states?
Very closely. Most of the activity has been in North Carolina and Virginia.
And Dr. Arson, let's pursue that for just a second, because if we were talking about Northwest Georgia as one of the places where we might see the biggest concentration of this, if we're talking about states being the primary regulators here, won't we also have problems if we're on the borders? If we're in Northwest Georgia, you've got Tennessee involved. If you go across in North Georgia, you've got Tennessee and North Carolina involved, because we're going underground here. Mm-hmm. And underground, the aquifers and the potential sources don't care about state borders. So is there a potential for conflict there?
There is definitely potential for conflicts always. I'm not the most qualified person to see which legal instruments would be the best to regulate hydraulic fracturing. What I know is that there's very few laws at the federal level. There is only a very few obligations for companies to be completely transparent about the fluids injected and the procedures to fabricate or to make the wells. A lot of problems reported were on the execution of the wells.
So is there a possibility, let me zero in on the more scientific part of this then, is there a possibility for groundwater contamination that we might not see for years? In other words, something gets in underground into the aquifer and it doesn't show up at the surface for quite a long time. Is that possible?
It is always possible to have a phenomena occurring deep in the earth and I think you would see pretty quickly if there's if something would happen in the aquifer, because you use the fresh water from there. Maybe what would be what would take time to show up in your measurements would be the groundwater at the location of the fracking. But there are many layers that are almost impermeable, separating the location of the fracking and the aquifers. So what that tells you is probably that proper monitoring, sensing, and instrumentation would be probably a good starting point to explore and to exploit oil and gas in a safer way.
We've been speaking with Dr. Chloe Arson with the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Georgia Tech, and Kurt Ebersbach with the senior energy attorney with Southern Environmental Law Center. I got that out. Thank you both for coming in and taking time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.